BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Later today, some of your thought-provoking reactions to my pre-Christmas interview with Disability Minister Sir Stephen Timms. But first of all, new year, new job. Ed Holloway has taken over as CEO of the Macular Society. Macular disease is the commonest form of visual impairment in the UK, especially affecting people as they get older. He takes over at a particularly exciting time when forms of the disease which have so far proved resistant to treatment are seeing real signs of progress. The Society is as much about living successfully with the condition as with looking for a cure. We usually give new CEOs time to get their feet under the table before interrogating them. And Ed Holloway, you have had your few months' grace, taking over as you did in last July. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the warm welcome.
Can we find out a bit more about you, first of all? I mean, tell me about your career so far.
Of course, very happy to. So I'm incredibly excited to be in this new role, as you say, 6 months in, so still very much finding my feet. But I'm a sort of charity sector lifer, really. So I've worked pretty much all in health and social care charities for 20 plus years, and probably most relevant to this role, spent, I think, about 14 years at the Multiple Sclerosis Society, which, although that's a very different condition in many ways, it's a similar sort of organisation that it has that focus on research, but also on supporting people living with the condition here and now.
So what attracted you to this job in particular, and how do you feel what you've done so far prepares you for it?
I joined the charity sector ultimately, it sounds very cheesy, but because I wanted to do something with my life where I felt I was making a difference and contributing to something that felt worthwhile. That's always been my motivation. And I think the Macular Society, it's an incredibly important cause, as you say, the leading cause of sight loss in the UK, affecting hundreds of thousands of people and having a really significant impact on their life. You know, the Macular Society does incredible work. It's a wonderful organisation, but I can see potential for us to do even more, to support more people and to make more progress in research. So it just felt like somewhere I hopefully can contribute and bring something useful to the organisation and ultimately to help us to beat macular disease.
It's fair to say you've got some pretty big shoes to fill in a way. Kathy Yelf was a regular contributor and a good friend to this programme, and both in terms of public policy on visual impairment and on involving people with the condition in the work of the society, she did a great deal to raise its profile. What in particular do you feel are the priorities now which you'd like to concentrate on in the job?
Yeah, as you say, some really intimidating shoes to fill. And, you know, it's, in some ways it's fantastic following on from a CEO who's done such a wonderful job, because it means the organisation's in great shape. I think in terms of my priorities, it's about continuing that really fantastic trajectory that Kathy had taken the organisation on. So we've seen really significant growth in our research expenditure over a number of years, and I'd like to see that continue. What we want to be doing as an organisation is focusing more on the clinical research and the, you know, eventually clinical trials, which hopefully can bring new treatments to bear against the condition. And then the other is growth in terms of the people that we're supporting. You know, we support around 100,000 people a year, whether that be through our local groups, through our website, our helpline, or reading our e-newsletter. And I think there's potential for that to grow significantly and us to help transform the lives of more people living with macular disease.
Yeah, because it does mean, although you're saying that number of 100,000, but we know that somewhere between 600,000 and 700,000 people have the condition, which means there are 500,000 who you're not really reaching.
Absolutely. I think that's a fair challenge, and it's one I've been sort of bringing to the team. And, you know, I think we do fantastic work for the size of organisation we are. You know, we're a sort of medium-sized charity, but we always need to bear in mind there are still significant numbers of people who we're not able to reach and support, and figuring out ways to do that, to develop services which are relevant to their lives and that we can deliver at the sort of scale that's necessary is a real challenge. And you mentioned Kathy's work on involving people living with macular disease, and I think that's so important, and it's something I really championed at the MS Society. I think where charities go wrong is when they think they know the solutions themselves. It's about talking to people affected, working alongside them to understand where the gaps are, what the organisation can do to usefully contribute. As we have been, you know, on a kind of positive growth trajectory for a number of years, but we really need to continue and accelerate that.
Among the specific issues you'll have to deal with are long waiting lists, very long waiting lists, insufficient public funding, I think, which the society would draw attention to, the absence of a national plan for eye care. How do you plan to tackle these?
Yeah, it's a really challenging environment. And I think what makes it particularly challenging is we're obviously talking about the issues affecting people living with macular disease, which is, you know, part of a broader sight loss sector. But if you speak to anyone in a similar role in any health charity in the UK, they'll be saying exactly the same things in terms of waiting lists, lack of resources, and lack of a national plan. So, you know, the NHS and in general public services are in a really challenging space. And what I think we need to do is just speak up really loudly and clearly for the needs of people living with macular disease, and to do that alongside others in the sector. So often our policy work, we do that in partnership because we think we can, you know, speak with a louder voice when we speak together. It's far more reasonable, I think, to call for things like a national eye plan rather than a national macular plan. So having that kind of consistent voice, but I don't think there are easy solutions, and we need to do everything we can to, you know, bring more resource into supporting people living with macular disease, but also make sure that that's organised and arranged in an efficient way as possible. And that's where a national plan could really contribute in making sure that things are linked up, that referrals work properly, that data sharing works properly at a local level.
If we can look specifically at one of the issues we mentioned there, those long waiting lists for treatment, there are developments which are giving some cause for optimism. We've been talking to Ben Hunt. He's the co-founder of a company called Siliton, and they've developed equipment which has the aim of radically speeding up diagnosis and could really make a difference to those waiting list lengths. His company's focus is on developing a new form of OCT scanner, which is a common way of finding out what's happening within the multiple layers of the eye.
We're using a technology called integrated photonics or photonic chips. And these are very much like the chips you'd find in your phone or your laptop. But those chips manipulate electricity and have allowed us to miniaturize complex electronics. And the chips we're working with are to manipulate light. But they share very many similarities with those chips that you're more familiar with. So they're mass manufacturable. They're very robust. And so they can be bumped around a bit more and they remain very highly functioning. And because they're mass manufacturable and we don't have to have that complicated manufacturing process, it brings the price of the devices down quite substantially as well. And of course, the most obvious thing is that by using these little chips, we can reduce the size of the devices from something that's about the size of a cash machine to kind of like a chunky pair of binoculars, which is what we're looking at the moment.
So that's obviously a lot more convenient and, by the sound of it, cheaper. What do you think this will actually change?
Well, what we're really working towards is a monitoring surface for patients with wet macular disease. And so the idea would be that a patient has their own scanner at home, which they use several times a week. And it'd be very simple to use and just take a minute or so to take your own OCT images. But those images can then be uploaded onto the internet and reviewed. And then you can very precisely decide when to bring a patient in for their next treatment. And this should really allow for a much better experience of patients. So they only ever have to go to a hospital when they need treatment. Mm. We hope to actually not only really carefully and precisely predict when patients need treatment, but also we hope to actually reduce the overall number of treatments because of that. And there is certainly evidence coming out of the USA that would suggest that we can do that reduction in overall treatments the patient receive while maintaining the same outcomes.
So you're saying not that people could treat themselves, but that they could monitor the progress of their eye condition in their own homes. I mean, this sounds pretty revolutionary. Is this really likely to happen? And if so, how soon?
And no, it does sound revolutionary, and I should emphasize that people won't be making their own treatment decisions, of course. We'll still be plugging in to ophthalmologists, that friendly person you see when you go to the hospital. But no, this is certainly reality, and certainly from the initial health economics assessments we've done, we hope the NHS will really endorse this, not only because it can lead to a better service that patients receive, but because it can save the NHS money. And how soon? Well, I'm afraid I'm going to say about 2030 is where we think our first regulated medical device will come out for patients to use in the home. But every day we're looking at ways that we can accelerate that timeline and bring it forward. But of course, this is a regulated medical device that has to undergo clinical trials and then medical regulation as well. And so it is, I'm afraid, a long timeline.
You say it will save a lot of money. Can you just kind of pare that down for me? How will it save money? And can you put that into figures?
Yeah, so I should emphasise this. These are early health economic models that we've had done by an independent health economics organisation. Depending exactly on what treatment regimen the patient is on, a saving of between £8,000 and £15,000 per patient over a 5-year period. And that reduction in cost is actually predominantly based on the reduction of the need in clinic appointments. So when the patient has to go into a hospital, obviously they need a room to have the OCT and they need a technician to operate it and all of the costs around that. So if we can remove that out of the hospital and be doing that in the home instead, then that's where that saving comes from. And then on top of that would be any savings in medication use. We estimate that if every patient with wet age-related macular degeneration in the UK had one of our scanners, we could save around £1 billion a year to the NHS. The other great side effect of that is that these patients had already got a diagnosis but need to be treated very precisely. Out of that workflow, we can then open up those machines and those technicians for new patients who are still waiting for diagnoses. And as you've covered before on the programme, the ophthalmology waiting list in the NHS is one of the longest. Whatever we can do to relieve that is, I'm sure, going to be much appreciated.
We're talking today mainly about macular disease, but could this technology be applied to other eye diseases?
Yes, well, certainly the home monitoring service, we think that diabetic macular edema would fit with that model and be similarly beneficial to patients that suffer from that condition. And then more broadly, you know, OCT is very difficult to break out of the clinic. For instance, in glaucoma, often the people that are most at risk of glaucoma aren't the ones that are coming to the regular screening appointments, or maybe they don't even have an optometrist set up in their area. And so we could power a remote screening service for glaucoma for the very first time, because OCT is a particularly key part of that.
Because the glaucoma is the issue of pressure building up in the eye, and you're saying that that could be identified without necessarily going for a hospital appointment.
Exactly. So OCT is becoming a particularly crucial tool for identifying glaucoma, because some patients have increased pressure in the eye, some patients don't. But it seems to be more or less universal that you can see features on the OCT that are symptomatic of glaucoma. And so along with a couple of other tests, like a visual fields test, which has already been made portable, OCT is really the missing link to a remote glaucoma screening service.
I imagine you're not the only company working in this field, are you?
Yeah, so we're not the only company looking at moving OCT out of the clinic and into the home. There's one particular in the US that's a few years ahead of us, but we're the only one looking at using these chips. So all the other companies are still trying to innovate with the older technology, with the mirrors and the lenses. And just at the end of October, we became the first company in the world to image a live human eye with a chip. We hope to be imaging our first patients in February as part of a study. So we're trying to push forward as quickly as we can.
Ben Hunt, who's a co-founder of Cilliton. Ed Holloway, listening to that, I mean, it's some mind-boggling stuff, really. And I understand the Macular Society has been working with Cilliton on this project. How optimistic are you about its potential? And are you slightly daunted that they're still saying 5 years to go?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty mind-blowing stuff, isn't it? So we've been working with them, as we work with lots of other companies and organisations, essentially to put them in touch with people living with macular disease, so that at an early stage, the views and, you know, the thoughts of people with the condition can be taken into account as they're designing and developing products. So we do this on a number of different things. Obviously, it'd be great if these things could come along sooner, but technology like this, it's got to be tested, it's got to be, you know, designed and developed properly, and it's got to be properly regulated. So, frankly, it's good to hear, you know, a realistic view on how long it's going to take to develop. It's always concerning sometimes when companies are overly optimistic. Mm.
And just finally, Ed, I mean, how optimistic are you that the various forms of macular disease can be brought not just under control, but maybe even we could think in terms of eradication. I mean, we have been hearing lately, for example, that dry AMD, which has so far resisted attempts to treat it successfully, there's progress in that area.
I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful. I think we're making progress. And I think, you know, now's a really exciting time for the field. It's a really exciting time to be joining the Macular Society. But I do think we have to be realistic. You know, we're starting to see progress. Those treatments are sort of modest in their effectiveness. And what often happens is, you know, the first treatments become available and then future generations improve on them. And over time, the treatments become more and more effective and the side effects become more controlled. So, you know, I think we're still some way off, but we are making significant progress. And I'm really proud of the role that the Macular Society plays in that.
Ed Holloway, thank you very much indeed. Happy New Year and good luck with the job. I'm sure we'll be inviting you back on the programme quite soon. Thank you.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Now, a couple of weeks before Christmas, we invited someone else fairly new to their job, the relatively new Minister for Social Security and Disability, Sir Stephen Timms, onto the programme to answer a range of your questions relating to blind and partially sighted issues. Not unexpectedly, we got a lot of response from you, but Christmas and New Year specials meant we haven't had the chance to feature them so far. So we're doing it now. For example, we asked about government plans to have more appropriate technology in job centres to help people handle job applications. Marcia Corper wasn't overly impressed.
Mr. Timms clearly thinks that all blind people are likely to use the same piece of IT kit, with JAWS, of course. If job centres did introduce fully accessible IT devices, who is going to teach the staff how to use them in order for them to teach the clients? Many of the clients are likely to be people who have recently lost their sight anyway and will not be up to speed with any such equipment.
And Marcia was also dissatisfied with the minister's response to a question bemoaning the emergence of so-called floating bus stops.
I also wonder if any of the new transport changes are ever really discussed with disability groups. Although as yet, I do not have the floating bus stop problem. I have to stand outside the bus shelter with my dog and her harness fully on view, rain or not, hoping a bus will stop for me. I can't hear the bus coming because of all the other traffic noise, and the buses frequently don't stop because I didn't leap out and wave madly at them.
We've all been there. Not unexpectedly, there was also a big response to the need to make touchscreens on card readers more accessible. Kev Clark had a practical suggestion.
I would like to propose that the banking industry adopt the same standard for card readers that is now used in mobile phone technology. It is now possible to unlock your phone and even pay for things on your phone using your fingerprint or Face ID. I would suggest the same could be done by the card reader, with the person's fingerprint or Face ID information stored on the card chip and accessed by the reader when authorising the payment.
Richard Foster's solution to the problem was more legal than scientific.
All websites should be accessible using screen reading equipment. With card payment machines, all should have buttons as well as or instead of a flat screen. The government could and should bring this in with a deadline and fines for organisations which don't comply. Accessibility for all is surely a basic human right and should be in place right now.
Well, that's just a flavour of what you sent us. And thank you for those. We read all your emails, and there are a number of ideas that we intend to pursue as items later in the year. Keep them coming. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk, leave messages on 01 0161 836 1338, and remember, we do have a website, bbc.co.uk/